Welcome to The Road We Travel, a production of Drive Smart Virginia. I'm Rich Jacobs. Our guest in this installment is President of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, David Harkey.
Let's set an interim target of 30 by 30. Let's reduce our fatalities by 30% by 2030 and get us back on the right trajectory to get to the point where we can reach that zero fatality number.
Our guest is David Harkey. David is president of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. And how long have you been in that position, David?
I've been here for almost 7 years now, Rich.
What got you into the traffic safety field?
So I am a civil engineer by training. And so I got my undergrad in civil, and then I got my bachelor's and PhD degree in civil as well, but with a focus in transportation. And ever since grad school, I've always been involved in road safety research. And so this is what I was doing when I started work as a consultant. Then I moved to the University of North Carolina's Highway Safety Research Center. That's what I was doing there, and then the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety.
The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety was founded in 1959 by a group of insurance companies. Is that still the situation, or is it completely separate, or how does that work?
No, and you know, you have to look back at when this was formed in 1959. It took a very forward-looking few executives in the insurance industry at that time to think we need a better way to go about looking at roadway safety. And you have to think about that era, right? We were in the era of muscle cars in the United States. There were lots of fatalities, no seat belts, of course. And so it really was forward-looking executives in the insurance industry at that time that decided we're going to set up a nonprofit road safety research center that can figure out how to improve safety on our roadways. And today, we are still funded by the insurance industry. In fact, we are about 92-93% of the insurance companies in the U.S. make up our membership, along with a couple companies in Canada.
And how you have grown the IIHS facility in Ruckersville is just amazing. We go out there once a year to watch one of the crash tests, and we'll talk about those in a minute. But the facility is just incredible. You have that huge outside, I don't even know what to call it. It's it's like a roof with no building under it. That you do stuff, testing where it has to be outdoors. And then, of course, you have the crash test facilities indoors. That is a very impressive place. Do you work in the Washington office or at Ruckersville? Because I know you have at least two offices.
Yeah, so I spend time in both. And so our headquarters, of course, is in Arlington. But it's our research center there in Ruckersville, which is where I probably spend a little more time because that's where our member companies want to visit. That's where outside guests want to visit. It's where we interact quite often with the automakers who come to see, test and meet with us about, what's going on with regards to the future of vehicle safety. And so that's where I probably spend a little more of my time, rather than in the Arlington office. But it is, as you said, a very impressive facility. And that facility, even though we were founded, as you say, in 1959, that facility was built in 1993. Mm-hmm. And we began testing vehicles there at that time. And then we did an expansion in 2015. And that's when we added the covered track, which is the big dome structure that you see. And we put that facility in place for a couple reasons. It allowed us to do tests either when the weather was not cooperating on our upper track or outdoor track. It also has turned out to be a great place for us to set up demonstrations for visitors who are coming to visit our facility. And so we can set up all kinds of collision avoidance demonstrations for them to see, and we don't have to worry about the weather.
And nothing drives home the message like seeing it in action. Talking about the Ruckersville place, before that was built, I assume IIHS was doing crash tests. Where was that happening?
Yeah, so there were still a limited number of tests that were going on outdoors, but we were not doing anything like we began doing when we built the indoor facility. Because, you know, one of the things that you need for doing any kind of tests like that is the ability to be repetitive, right? Mm-hmm. And be redundant in the way that you're going about testing, particularly since we were looking at not only doing research with regards to some of the testing, but also launching our consumer evaluation program, where you are now, you know, comparing vehicle A with manufacturer X against vehicle B with manufacturer Y. And so you had to have a facility where you could control as many of the variables as you could. And so that was the advantage of building our crash hall, crash facility.
So that way, every test is done under the same conditions. So no temperature variation, absolutely, no humidity changes, you know, wet track, dry track, that kind of stuff. Everything is done under exactly the same conditions, which makes it very fair.
Absolutely. And we have a very rigorous protocol for every test that we run. And the other advantage of that is that all of the automakers, as well as some independent test facilities throughout the country, can also run our test to the same conditions as we have defined in our protocols. And so, you know, it allows them to run these tests at their facilities. That way, when we go to test the vehicle, there are no surprises.
Right. All right. Let's talk about the crash test rating. For people not in the traffic safety field, their familiarity with IIHS might end with the 5-star crash rating that I imagine every automobile manufacturer wants to have so they can put it in their advertising. What's the process for that? I guess one question would be, who supplies the cars and trucks?
It's a great question. We get that quite often. We go purchase the vehicles from a dealership just like you or I would as an individual consumer. We do not get vehicles directly from the manufacturer. We do not want them doing anything to the vehicle or any particular tests that we might run. And so we purchase them right off the lot, and we pay the same prices that any consumer would pay. During the pandemic, we were paying more just like everybody else. And so that's one of the things that, you know, maintains our independence when it comes to the tests that we run, and the validity of the tests that we run is, you know, we are an independent nonprofit research and evaluation organization.
So you purchase the car, and then it has to be outfitted with all these sensors. When I first started watching the crash tests, I think there was like an umbilical cord that came off the car or something like that. But now everything seems to be mounted in the trunk or in the back of the vehicle.
Yeah, we use a lot of technology to make sure that, and redundant technology to make sure that we get all of the measurements. And so there are, you know, sensors in the vehicles, there are cameras in the vehicles, there are cameras outside the vehicles that record things in very high speed so that we can go back and analyze the video from the test, because we're often looking at not just the measures that we get from the dummies, from the sensors that are in the dummies and from sensors that are in the vehicles. But we are also looking at the kinematics. What happens to the dummies during the test? How do they move? Does their head hit a hard structure in the vehicle? You know, does the airbag work as it should have? So we're looking at a lot of different things, both during the test, but a lot of the stuff that goes on occurs in terms of the evaluation occurs after the test is over. And we do transmit all of that data now over our Wi-Fi sensors and connectors. And so to make sure that we get everything, and we download all of that information immediately after the test. And one of the things that's new nowadays is, you know, we're running more and more electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're running vehicles that have these big batteries connected to them. And we discharge those batteries by about 90% before we run a test. And so we have enough power in there to make sure that the electronics, ignition systems, anything that we have to turn on will remain powered before and during the test. And then we take a couple other precautions for those vehicles these days. One is we have the local fire department. They're on site whenever we are running a test, just in case there is some sort of thermal event with that battery. Luckily, we've never had that, but they are there as a precaution. And then the other thing that we do is after the test, we have one of our engineering techs make sure that there is no discharge to the vehicle itself, so that when our technicians come in and start touching the vehicle and the electronics and that they're not going to get shocked in any way.
Right. Kind of the same stuff first responders have to do when they deal with an EV fire.
Exactly.
The results from the crash tests are sent to the manufacturers. And the ones I've been to, it seemed like there were some manufacturer representatives there witnessing the crash test. Once they get that data, I guess the hope is that they will improve those vehicles for the next version and that they will perform better. Looking over how safe vehicles are, you guys at the Ruckersville office had a great display of I think it was a 56 or 57 Chevrolet, maybe it was an older one than that, Bel Air, that had crashed into another modern Chevrolet in a crash test, and that it was like a driver-side-to-driver-side crash. And anyone who sees that, it would certainly silence people who say, well, you know, back in the day, they built them better. They built them out of real steel back then, you know. The old car was absolutely destroyed, unsurvivable. But the modern car looked like maybe you could have walked away from that one. You know, it just didn't look all that bad inside the passenger compartment. How responsive have manufacturers been to the results of the crash tests as far as improving their vehicles?
Yeah, but, and I would say very responsive, right? I mean, that is the hope. That is the cycle that we go through. We try to figure out what the problems are with regards to crashes that are occurring on our highways. And then we look for opportunities to either improve our tests, make our tests a little tougher, or maybe come up with a new test that we think is warranted that will then drive those improvements in the auto industry once they start to see the results of those tests. And that's been a success story. And that's exactly how things have worked since we started doing this in the early 90s. And the event, the test that you were referring to, and it's available on our YouTube channel. If anybody wants to go find IHS on the YouTube channel, you can see the video of that particular test. And that was for our 50th anniversary in 2009. And we took a 1959
Malibu.
Bel Air.
Oh, Bel Air.
Yeah, and a 2009 Malibu, right? And right. So it's that 50-year span to see how they would perform in this, as you said, you know, the kind of the driver side to driver side overlap test. And they both weigh about the same amount.
Really? I would have thought the older car would be much heavier, just even looking at it.
Yeah. But one of the things you have now, you know, of course, you know, the engines you have, all of the structure and the energy absorbing structures that you have in the newer vehicle at that time compared to the Bel Air. There is a lot of metal, but there's also a lot of space. And so in those vehicles. And so weight wise about the same, but structurally and from a safety performance standpoint, there was just no comparison. You were absolutely right. You could have probably walked away from the crash if you were in that Malibu. You would definitely have been killed if you were in that Bel Air.
Oh, yeah.
And so safety has performed so much during that 50-year span. But if you look then from that, let's take that time point, 2009, to where we are today in 2024, vehicles have continued to improve dramatically in terms of safety. And so, you know, not only do they do a much better job, we have more airbags, more supplemental restraint systems than we've ever had in vehicles today. The energy absorbing structures have gotten better. The steel alloys and materials have gotten better. Everything has just improved. And so vehicles today compared to even 2009 are much safer.
And I know that, well, I assume based on what I've seen that you change up those tests occasionally. You don't want to just run the same test on one side of a vehicle because you want to make sure that they're not just beefing up the part that you're testing, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's and the perfect example of that was a test that we started somewhere around, I think it was, let me see if I can find the right date for you before I tell you. But yeah, it was right around 2011 or so that we began doing this. It was what we called our small overlap test. So we do three frontal tests. So we run a moderate overlap where 40% of the front of the vehicle on the driver's side strikes a barrier. And then that was our first test. And then we developed a small overlap test to take only 25% of the front of the vehicle striking the barrier. So this is kind of outside the frame rails, and that energy is concentrated in that one portion of the vehicle. And we started running that test. And sure enough, this is a harder test. Manufacturers struggled when we first introduced this test. And over time, they've gotten better. But one of the things that happened was we did discover exactly what you just described, that the manufacturers were beefing up the driver's side of the vehicle, but not the passenger side. They weren't putting the same intervention and the same countermeasure on that side of the vehicle. So we started running a test on the passenger side as well. And so at this stage in our testing, both sides now pretty much perform equally well. And so we've overcome that problem. But that is something we have to watch out for.
Well, beyond the crash tests, which are a trove of data, I imagine, you're involved with other aspects of transportation safety. For instance, headlights, automated vehicle, autonomous vehicle testing, safety features. What other testing do you do besides the crash testing?
Yeah, and so that's probably where the biggest advancement in technology has really occurred over the past decade plus. And so everything from front crash prevention systems that in some cases started out as warning you if you were getting too close to a vehicle in front of you. Some of these were radar-based, some of these are camera-based, some of them put all that information together in a fusion way, but started testing automatic emergency braking systems. And those systems have come a long way. They've gotten so much better in terms of being able to not only address vehicle-to-vehicle type collisions, but vehicle into pedestrians, for example. And so a lot of these systems now can do a really good job of helping you avoid both vehicles and pedestrians. Headlights is a big one. We're the only ones in the world that do this kind of in-vehicle testing, post-production testing of headlights. And that has made a huge difference in terms of not only getting the headlights to be better in terms of visibility, how far down the road you can see as a driver, but the other big improvement that we've seen in headlights is a reduction in glare for the oncoming driver.
That is the biggest complaint I hear about headlights today, is that they're glaring. They just blind you. If somebody is, say, coming over the crest of the hill and that headlight beam catches you in the passenger compartment as the two cars kind of come back to the same attitude, if that makes sense. But
it's a big problem. And it's one that, we started testing headlights in 2016, and a lot of them did not perform well for several years. And so we're just now getting to the point where I think we're starting to see a lot more what we refer to as, good rated headlights that do reduce that glare and improve visibility. One of the things you have to remember, and I always try to remind people of this, is that the average age of a vehicle these days is 12 years.
That's about right. Yeah. I think mine is 12 years old. I'm right in there.
There you go. And so you have to remember that that goes back prior to when we even started rating headlights. And it's going to include a lot of vehicles that either got very poor ratings from us or we had not rated yet. And so there's still a lot of vehicles on the road today that do have unrated or poor rated or marginally rated headlights. And so it's going to just take a little time before I would say we get most of those vehicles off the road that have these better performing headlights. And hopefully that glare problem will diminish as time goes by.
What about the human factors? We've talked about the vehicle testing, and we've talked about accessories and safety features that you test, including headlights. But the problem that we're seeing nationally and here in Virginia is that some drivers developed some very bad habits during COVID, and they're still practicing them now, like speeding, not wearing their seat belts, driving with their nose in the phone instead of pointing ahead where it belongs. What research, if any, does the IIHS do into the human factor?
Yeah, and it's an extremely important point. So one of the things that we look at are all aspects of the system. And you think about the road safety system. So you have the vehicle, you have the infrastructure, and we do work looking at infrastructure as well. Things like how well do roundabouts perform, and can we put more of those in because they are can reduce fatalities at intersections by 80%. So we look at a lot of infrastructure things, but by far the biggest challenge we have is behavior on our roadways. It is the human factors element. And we do a lot of work in trying to figure out what are the best policies that you can put in place to address some of the behavioral issues. What are the best practices from an enforcement standpoint, from a technology standpoint that you may add to the infrastructure, things like speed safety cameras? What are the various ways that we can counteract some of the behavioral issues? And you mentioned the big ones, and they have been with us forever in road safety. They certainly got exacerbated, as you pointed to, during the pandemic and have remained to be problems. Speeding still counts for about a quarter of our fatalities. Speed-related fatalities account for about a quarter of those. And impairment still accounts for almost a third of our fatalities in this country. That's a big one.
Not to interrupt you, I'm sorry. Well, of course I interrupted you. But here in Virginia, marijuana has been decriminalized. So that maybe adds a little bit to the impairment part of the equation.
Yeah, the interesting thing about marijuana is, and we've been looking at that since states began making it legal for recreational use. And so, and we saw some bumps early on in terms of crash frequencies in some of the early states like Colorado and Washington and places like that. And we've continued to monitor that. But one of the most significant research studies that we got involved in, looking at actual emergency room instances where there were crashes, what we really found was it wasn't marijuana alone that was the biggest culprit. It was the poly substance abuse. It was alcohol and marijuana combined. And so your risk of being involved in a crash if you were using alcohol increased about threefold. Your risk of being involved in a crash when you were using marijuana and alcohol combined increased about fivefold.
Wow.
And so that's the thing that we're really trying to pay attention to. And one of the reasons that's so important is when you think about enforcing any kind of rules around impairment, we don't yet have a complete understanding of the impact of THC within marijuana on human physiology and how that affects impairment. It's not like BAC. We have a good understanding on the alcohol side. And so we need to do more work in that area. And we also don't have the tools for law enforcement at this point in time to really enforce the marijuana side of things. But what all that research pointed to is that if you enforce the alcohol side, which we do have tools for and which we understand very well, you will also capture a large portion of those who are impaired by marijuana. And I think that's a really important thing for law enforcement to understand.
Yeah, that's because, like you said, they're using both.
Yeah.
That's, driving after drinking is like putting a bullet in a gun and playing Russian roulette. I guess if you add more substances to that, you're just adding more bullets to the chambers and increasing the likelihood that you will be involved in a crash. And you're playing Russian roulette, not just with yourself, but with the lives of the people around you. So that's a really new idea that, you're looking for the one and you might find both.
Yep. That's it. And I think that's what we're trying to do is just to make people understand that the combination of these substances increases likelihood of being involved in a crash. And so, you know, we don't want anyone out there impaired. I don't care what the substance is. I don't, you know, whether it is alcohol, whether it is marijuana, whether it is prescription drugs, we do not want anyone on the roadway who is impaired. And it is that, you know, combination of substances where we have seen this now increased level of risk. And that is certainly not, you know, where we really have an issue these days is, you know, as you said, it's not just you. It's anyone who may be in the vehicle with you. It is all of those who are on the roadway with you. And so it's not just impacting your life. It's all those who are around you.
The IIHS gathers data from crash tests. You gather data from other testing. You do tons of research. Tell me about the Highway Loss Data Institute.
Yeah, so our Highway Loss Data Institute was established in 1972. So the institute was in 59. The Highway Loss Data Institute was in 72. And one of the benefits of the Highway Loss Data Institute is that we get claims data. So we get information from the bigger companies who are members of our organization. And it amounts to, we get about 85% of the claims that occur in the nation we have in our database. That database is extremely valuable for much of our research because it gives us very early insights into some of the problems that we may find on our roadways or with vehicles. I used to joke that when I was at the University of North Carolina's Highway Safety Research Center, I was always jealous that the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety seemed to know before we did some of the trends that were coming or some of the trends that were happening. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that the claims data from the insurance industry come in much quicker to Hildy than police crash reports come to the state system and then are available for researchers.
Wow.
And so we've always had the ability at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety and the Highway Loss Data Institute to be able to more quickly identify what some of the challenges are on our roadways. And it's an extremely valuable resource, not just to us internally as researchers, but to the road safety community at large, to have a different set of data that we can use to identify what our challenges are. You know, one of the things that's important to understand about our crash test or our collision avoidance test is we are always seeking opportunities to improve. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that we have going on right now. Our side crash test that was introduced back in 2003 was extremely effective. When we look at real-world crashes following our test period, and this goes back to the discussion we had about getting the vehicle industry to improve their vehicles. And so if we look over time from the time we introduced that test to how the vehicle industry improved, and then ultimately for us, what is our measure of success is, has this reduced real-world fatalities in those kinds of crashes? Well, that requires us looking at police crash reports over time. And for our side crash test, the answer was yes, that if you were in a vehicle that got a good rating in our side crash test, you were 70% less likely to be killed than if you were in a vehicle that got a poor rating. That's an extremely powerful success story for that particular crash. But what we also learned, we started doing more research around 2015, about a quarter of the fatalities still occur in those kinds of side crashes on our roadways. And so we thought there's more room for improvement here. And so we started developing a tougher side crash test that has about 80% more energy than in our old test. We use a heavier barrier. It's been redesigned to look more like the front ends of the larger pickups and SUVs that we now have on our roads compared to when the original test was done. We're running at a higher speed in our test, 37 miles per hour versus 31 miles per hour.
Oh, and by the way, if you haven't seen a crash test, that speed may not sound like much. But when that, I mean, you realize 35 miles an hour is real fast when you hit something or someone.
Yeah. Yeah. And we often get that question, you know, why do you not run tests at much higher speeds? And there's a couple answers for that. One is that the majority of the tests, 75-80% of the crashes in real world actually occur at the speeds we test at, about 40 miles per hour, or a little less, in the real world. Because oftentimes, even if you're traveling at a faster rate of speed, by the time you impact the other vehicle, you've taken some action to potentially brake. And so a lot of the tests occur at that lower speed. The other thing to remember is that there's only so much that the vehicle structure is going to do in terms of protecting you. And when you get to really high speeds of 50 miles per hour and greater, then the structure of the vehicles that we have today are not likely to perform very well. And to build a structure that would perform better in those much higher speeds, it would either be a much heavier vehicle or a much more expensive vehicle that simply would not be affordable. So that's what you'd have to do. But the new side crash test, when we rolled that out, we looked at 20 small SUVs as a starting point. All the 20 of those small SUVs got a good rating in our original side crash test. Only one of those vehicles got a good rating in our tougher side crash test. And so it's back to the automakers now. How do I make my vehicle perform better? And they're slowly, as we've introduced this test over the last couple of years, they are slowly making their vehicles better. And so they will offer more protection to a consumer if they get into that type of crash. And that's what we do. That's the cycle we go through almost constantly, trying to look for where are those opportunities, where are the challenges, and how do we make things a little tougher, a little harder, and drive the industry to do better, as well as how do we do the same thing when it comes to infrastructure and behaviors.
So what's on the horizon for IIHS? What are you looking in toward the future with autonomous vehicles, which I know are, I think autonomous vehicles, or the path we're taking toward autonomous vehicles, we're at one of the most dangerous times in that evolution, because the self-driving capabilities, just as an example, have gotten so good. They still tell the driver, you have to pay attention, you have to have your hands on the wheel, but it's good enough that it lulls the driver into a sense of overconfidence in the equipment. And until we get to the point where the equipment's actually that good, we have to do something to keep the driver engaged. And I think that's a really tough place to be right now.
Yeah, it's a real challenge, because you're absolutely right that these systems have gotten better at being able to perform certain tasks. And so where we are today with a lot of the vehicles that you can go buy as a consumer has what we refer to as partial driving automation capabilities, where it has that braking and throttle control through systems like adaptive cruise control combined with lane keeping. And so it provides the steering input to keep you in the lane. And of course, some of those systems are advertised as hands-free systems. And, having driven some of these systems, it is a little unnerving how well they work sometimes. And so I'm always one of those people, when I'm driving those systems, my hands are always ready. If I take my hands off the wheel to test these systems, my hands are always immediately ready. But not everybody's going to be like that. And you make a very good point that we are very much worried about people who will become complacent or over-reliant on this technology. And it is something that we have subsequently rolled out something we call our safeguard ratings. And so these are ratings of these systems that are on our website. And you can go look at some of the vehicles, the initial round of vehicles that we rated. And we did not give any of those vehicles our top rating. We thought there were problems with all of them, various aspects. And so whether it was simple things like you were actually able to use the system without having your seatbelt buckled, which seems like a no-brainer.
It would.
Or whether it was, something to do with the fact that the system didn't allow you to, didn't cooperate with you. And so if you put any steering inputs in as a driver, it would turn the autonomous system off. And so, you know, and again, these are supposed to be driving assist systems that are helping you. And that's not an assistance function. So that is certainly one of the things that we are concerned about moving forward, is what's going to happen with the technology. Another area that we're focused on as we move forward into the future here is doing more with commercial motor vehicles. Commercial motor vehicle fatalities, like much of the fatalities picture in the United States, has been going in the wrong direction. There are more trucks on the road these days than there have ever been. And you have the combination of different types of commercial motor vehicles that we're concerned about, both the heavy trucks that are transporting goods on our roadways, as well as the delivery trucks that we all see in our neighborhoods. And so that are showing up sometimes multiple times a day at our houses. And it will follow the mail order that we have, right?
Right. Oh, wait, I gotta go to the Amazon drivers at the door.
That's right. And so I think that's an area that we are concerned about, and we're going to be putting some more resources into doing more looking at some of these vehicles and what do they have in terms of technology and crash prevention capabilities. And so we're going to be doing more in that area. And then the other big focus will remain for us: how do we reduce the risky behavior that we have on our roads? And we will continue to try and figure out how to address speeding, how to address impairment, distraction, and how to get people to wear their seatbelt. You know, it's one of these, odd facts. Hell, it's just one of these weird facts in road safety that just drives me absolutely crazy, which is when you look at observed seatbelt use, 90% of those in the front seat, about 75% of those in the back seat appear to be using their belts. Yet when we look at fatalities in passenger cars, half of those in the front seat who are killed are not wearing their seatbelt.
Mm-hmm.
That has to change.
Yep. And the seatbelt use rate in Virginia is not great. I haven't seen the new numbers yet, but the numbers for 2022, I think it was, were pretty bad. Every year, Drive Smart Virginia has a distracted driving summit somewhere in the state. And that's one of our big pushes, is to help people understand how dangerous it is to drive and try to manipulate your phone at the same time. Social media has become so woven into our lives in some place. We do a lot of our advertising on social media because that's the quickest, most efficient way to get our message out to people. But how do we, and I see it every day, every trip to and from work, I look over as I'm driving down the road and see people with their phone in front of their face while they drive. What can be done to help people understand how dangerous that is? Or what can be done with the vehicles to make it so that they can't do it, which of course would drive everybody crazy?
Clearly, we have to continue to try and get messaging out there to folks that this is not a safe thing to do, and it's something you just need to continue to hammer that home. We've got to figure out, and one of the things we keep talking about internally is how do we come up with more effective messaging? And I think we have to continue to work on that. I do think technology can offer some hope as we move forward. Immediately, I wish we could get the phone companies, the mobile device companies,
the manufacturers,
to do things where, you know, they all have now, all of our devices have do not disturb features or a form of that, but it requires you as the user to turn that on. That should be a default that is on the phone when you purchase it. And you would have to either turn it off, or you have to be able to link it to the vehicle so that if the vehicle is moving at a certain speed, that it's not going to operate. And I know there's a lot of pushback and different reasons for why people don't want to go that route, but I think this is still something we ought to pursue. I think the other piece of technology that we're going to see more of in new vehicles as we move forward are driver monitoring systems that have the ability, you know, some of these systems now, the hands-free systems that we were talking about earlier, have cameras that are pointed at the driver already. They are monitoring the driver in some cases. But I think you're going to see more of those systems potentially come into vehicles. And I think they could be a real asset to help with this particular problem to make sure that you are not distracted, that your eyes are looking forward on the road, that you do not have something in your hands that you're fiddling with. So I think these are the kinds of things that we have to look forward to in the future. The challenge, of course, with anything that's coming into vehicles, as we mentioned earlier, average age of a vehicle is 12 years, and it takes a long time for the fleet to turn over. And so, you know, getting to a point where you have saturated the market with, you know, 85-90% of the vehicles have a particular technology takes decades.
Yeah.
And so it's not a quick fix.
Well, on that happy note, it's been great talking with you. I'm just so impressed with the IIHS and the work it does and the positive effect it's had on vehicle manufacturers. There's no telling how many safety innovations have been introduced in order to address the crash test and the data the invaluable data that they provide.
I will give you one more positive thing to close on.
Okay, that'd be great.
Well, one of the things that we are doing now is working on our strategic plan for the next 5 years as an organization, trying to figure out where we think our priorities should be, what we should be focused on. And we really are going to focus on three things. One is safety for everyone, with a focus on not only occupants in the vehicles of various sizes, genders, et cetera, but also looking at vulnerable road users,
right,
whose fatality numbers are going up much faster than all fatality numbers. And so that's an area we need to focus on. We're also going to focus on the commercial vehicle aspect of things that I mentioned earlier. And then we're going to continue to tackle how we go about reducing those risky behaviors that drivers engage in. Those are going to be our three pillars that we really concentrate on. One of the big things that we still believe in is working toward zero fatalities. And I know there are a lot of programs all around the country, within states, within cities, various descriptors, but all trying to get to a point where we have zero fatalities on our roadway. And I agree with that, but we are not even going in the right direction.
Yeah.
Nationally, our fatalities have gone up 31% in the last decade. So our vision as an organization, and something that we hope everyone can buy into, is let's set an interim target of 30 by 30. Let's reduce our fatalities by 30% by 2030 and get us back on the right trajectory to get to the point where we can reach that zero fatality number. I think if we can do that, we can start to see some success in various aspects of the safe system on our roadways and hopefully drive us toward that zero fatality goal.
Setting a reasonable goal.
Exactly. And I think it's just something that we all need in the road safety community is to, you know, zero just seems so far away, especially when you're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and that's my point. I didn't mean to imply that zero fatalities was not attainable, but the effort to get there can get a little frustrating if you're not hitting some incremental goals on your way there. I think that's a terrific idea.
Yeah. You know, it's the old saying, success breeds success.
There you go.
And I feel like that's where we are, right? We need to show that we can have some success in road safety and then start to turn things around and hopefully then get to that zero goal.
David Harkey is president of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Thanks so much for joining us on The Road We Travel. David, I appreciate you taking so much time out of your busy day.
Thank you, Rich. I appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to The Road We Travel, a production of Drive Smart Virginia. If you have a suggestion, guest, topic, what have you, send me an email, rich.jacobs@drivesmartva.org. And be sure to visit our website, drivesmartva.org. This has been The Road We Travel.